calm in the midst of this latest evidence of the physical world's relentlessness, and found a breath of it in the Bhagavad Gita, the 700-stanza devotional poem interpolated into the great Aryan epic Mahabharata at about the same time that Greece was declining from its golden age. He had discovered the Gita at Harvard. At Berkeley, he had learned Sanskrit from the scholar Arthur Ryder to set himself closer to the original text, and thereafter a worn pink copy occupied an honored place on the bookshelf closest to his desk. There are meanings enough for a lifetime in the Gita, dramatized as a dialogue between a warrior prince named Arjuna and Krishna, the principal avatar of Vishnu, and Vishnu, the third member of the Hindu godhead with Brahma and Shiva, a trinity again. Vannevar Bush records the particular meaning Oppenheimer clutched that desperate Saturday in July. He was a profoundly complex character, so my comment will be brief. I simply record a poem which he translated from the Sanskrit, and which he recited to me two nights before Trinity. In battle, in forest, at the precipice in the mountains, on the dark great sea, in the midst of javelins and arrows, in sleep, in confusion, in the depths of shame, the good deeds a man has done before, defend him. Back at base camp, Oppenheimer slept no more than 4 hours that night. Farrell heard him stirring restlessly on his bunk in the next room of the quarters they shared, racked with coughing. Chain-smoking, as much as meditative poetry, drove him through his days. Sturdy Hans Bethe found a way back from the precipice, Kistiakowski remembers. Sunday morning, another phone call came with wonderful news. Hans Bethe spent the whole night of Saturday analyzing the electromagnetic theory of this experiment and discovered that the instrumental design was such that even a perfect implosion could not have produced oscilloscope records different from what was observed. So I became again acceptable to local high society. When Groves called, Oppenheimer chatted happily about the Bethe results. The general interrupted, "What about the weather?" "The weather is whimsical," the whimsical physicist said. The Gulf air mass had stagnated over the test site, but change was coming. Jack Hubbard, the meteorologist, predicted light and variable winds the next day. Stagnation exacerbated the July heat. Camera crews replacing battery packs damaged by a blown circuit burned their hands on metal camera housings. Frank Oppenheimer, thin enough not to suffer the heat unduly, hurried to construct a last-minute experiment less aloof than readings of light and radiation. He set out boxes filled with excelsior and posts nailed with corrugated iron strips to simulate the fragile Japanese houses where LeMay's ubiquitous drill presses lurked. Groves had forbidden the construction of full-scale housing for the test. More scientific tomfoolery, a waste of money and time. Norris Bradbury's instructions for bomb assembly as of Saturday listed, "Gadget complete." For Sunday, 15 July, all day, he advised his crews, to look for rabbit's feet and four-leaved clovers. "Should we have the chaplain down there?" Rabbit's feet would turn up, but even chaplains would have had trouble finding a stem of clover on the Jornada. Oppenheimer, Groves, Bainbridge, Farrell, Tolman, and an army meteorologist met with Hubbard at McDonald Ranch at 4 that afternoon to consider the weather. Hubbard reminded them that he had never liked the July 16th date. He thought the shot could go as scheduled, he noted in his journal, in less than optimum conditions, which would require sacrifices. Groves and Oppenheimer repaired to another room to confer. They decided to wait and see. They had scheduled a last weather conference for the next morning at 0200 hours. They would make up their minds then. The shot was set for 0400, and they let that time stand. Sometime early that evening, Oppenheimer climbed the tower to perform a final ritual inspection. There before him crouched his handiwork. Its bandages had been removed, and it was hung now with insulated wires that looped from junction boxes to the detonator plugs that studded its dark bulk, an exterior ugly as Caliban's. His duty was almost done. At dusk, the tired laboratory director was calm. He stood with Cyril Smith beside the reservoir at McDonald Ranch, where cattle had watered, and spoke of families and home, even of philosophy, and Smith found himself soothed. A storm was blowing up. Oppenheimer looked beneath it to Anchorage, to the darkening Oscuras. "Funny how the mountains always inspire our work," the metallurgist heard him say. With the weather changing from stagnant to violent, and with everyone short of sleep, mood swung at base camp. The occasion of Fermi's satire that evening made Bainbridge furious. It merely irritated Groves. "I had become a bit annoyed with Fermi when he suddenly offered to take wagers from his fellow scientists on whether or not the bomb would ignite the atmosphere, and if so, whether it would merely destroy New Mexico or destroy the world. He had also said that, after all, it wouldn't make any difference whether the bomb went off or not, because it would still have been a well worthwhile scientific experiment. For if it did fail to go off, we would have proved that an atomic explosion was not possible." On the realistic grounds, the Italian laureate explained, with his usual candor, that the best physicists in the world would have tried and failed. Bainbridge was furious because Fermi's thoughtless bravado might scare the soldiers, who did not have the benefit of a knowledge of thermonuclear ignition temperatures and fireball cooling effects. But a new force was about to be loosed on the world. No one could be absolutely certain, at Fermi's point, of the outcome of its debut. Oppenheimer had assigned Edward Teller the deliciously Tellerian task of trying to think of any imaginable trick or turn by which the explosion might escape its apparent bounds. Teller, at Los Alamos that evening, raised the same question Fermi had, but questioned Robert Serber, no mere uninformed GI. "Trying to find my way home in the darkness, I bumped into an acquaintance, Bob Serber. That day, we had received a memo from our director saying that we would have to be at Trinity well before dawn, and that we should be careful not to step on a rattlesnake. I asked Serber, 'What will you do tomorrow about the rattlesnakes?' He said, 'I'll take a bottle of whiskey.' I then went into my usual speech, telling him how one could imagine that things might get out of control in this, that, or a third manner. But we had discussed these things repeatedly, and we could not see how, in actual fact, we could get into trouble. Then I asked him, 'And what do you think about it?' There in the dark, Bob thought for a moment, then said, 'I'll take a second bottle of whiskey.'" Robbie, the real mystic among them, spent the evening playing poker. Bainbridge managed a little sleep. He headed to the arming party charged with arming the bomb. He was due at zero by 11 p.m. to prepare the shot. An MP sergeant woke him at 10. He picked up Kistiakowsky and Joseph McKibben, the tall, lanky, Missouri-born physicist responsible for running the countdown, and assembled with Hubbard and his crew and two security men. "On the way in," Bainbridge remembers, "I stopped at S-10,000 and locked the main sequence timing switches. Pocketing the key, I returned to the car and continued to point zero." A young Harvard physicist, Donald Hornig, was busy in the tower. He had designed the 500-pound X unit of high-voltage capacitors that fired Fat Man's multiple detonators with microsecond simultaneity, a crucial Luis Alvarez invention, and now was disconnecting the unit Bainbridge's crews had used for practice runs and connecting the new unit, reserved for the shot. In static test, this Fat Man would be fired through cables from the S-10,000 control bunker. The one to be shipped to Tinian, self-contained, would carry onboard batteries. Cables or batteries would charge the X unit, and on command, it would discharge its capacitors to the detonators, vaporizing wires embedded in the explosive blocks to start shockwaves to set off the HE. "Soon after our arrival," says Bainbridge, "Hornig completed his work and returned to S-10,000. Hornig was the last man to leave the top of the tower. Hubbard operated a portable weather station at the tower. To measure wind speed and direction, the two sergeants who worked with him inflated and released helium balloons. At 11 o'clock, he found the wind blowing across zero toward N-10,000. At midnight, the Gulf air mass had thickened to 17,000 feet and arranged two inversions, cooler air above warmer, within its layered depths, that might loop the radioactive Trinity Column back down to the ground, directly below. To an observer traveling toward the desert from Los Alamos, the night was dark with black clouds, and not a star could be seen. Thunderstorms began lashing the Jornada at about 0200 hours on July 16th, drenching base camp and S-10,000. It was raining cats and dogs, lightning and thunder, Robbie remembers. We were really scared that this object there in the tower might be set off accidentally. So you can imagine the strain on Oppenheimer. Winds gusted to 30 miles an hour. Hubbard hung on at zero for last-minute readings. Only misting drizzle had yet reached the tower area, and arrived 8 minutes late for the 0200 weather conference at base camp to find Oppenheimer waiting for him outside the weather center there. Hubbard told him they would have to scrub 0400, but should be able to shoot between 0500 and 0600. Oppenheimer looked relieved. Inside, they found an agitated Groves waiting with his advisors. "What the hell is wrong with the weather?" the general greeted his forecaster. Hubbard took the opportunity to repeat that he had never liked July 16th. Groves demanded to know when the storm would pass. Hubbard explained its dynamics. A tropical air mass, night rain, afternoon thunderstorms took their energy from the heating of the earth and collapsed at sunset. This one, contrary-wise, would collapse at dawn. Groves growled that he wanted a specific time, not an explanation. "I'm giving you both," Hubbard rejoined. He thought Groves was ready to cancel the shot, which seems unlikely given the pressure from Potsdam. He told Groves he could postpone it if he wanted, but the weather would relent at dawn. Oppenheimer applied himself to soothe his bulky comrade. Hubbard was the best man around, he insisted, and they ought to trust his forecast. The others at the meeting, Tallman and two Army meteorologists, one more than before, agreed. Groves relented. "You'd better be right on this," he threatened Hubbard, "or I will hang you." He ordered the meteorologist to sign his forecast and set the shot for 0530. Then he went off to roust the governor of New Mexico out of bed to the telephone to warn him he might have to declare martial law. Bainbridge at zero was less concerned with local effects than with distant, even though he had personally locked open the circuits that communicated with the shelters. Sporadic rain was a disturbing factor, he recalls. We had none of the lightning reported by those at base camp about 16,000 yards away or at S-10,000, but it made interesting conversation, as many of the wires from NSW-10,000 ended at the tower. About 0330, a gust of wind at base camp collapsed Vannevar Bush's tent. He found his way to the mess hall, where from 0345, the cooks began serving a breakfast of powdered eggs, coffee, and French toast. The gods sent Emilio Segre happier amusement. He had distracted himself through the evening with André Gide's The Counterfeiters and slept through the worst of the base camp storm. But my attention was attracted by an unbelievable noise whose nature escaped me completely. As the noise persisted, Sam Allison and I went out with a flashlight and, much to our surprise, found hundreds of frogs in the act of making love in a big hole that had filled with water. Hubbard departed base camp at 0315 for S-10,000. The rain had moved on. He telephoned zero. One of his men there said the clouds were opening and a few stars shone. By 0400, the wind was shifting toward the southwest, away from the shelters. The meteorologist prepared his final forecast at S-10,000. He called Bainbridge at 0440. Hubbard gave me a complete weather report, the Trinity director recalls, and a prediction that at 5:30 a.m., the weather at point zero would be possible but not ideal. We would have preferred no inversion layer at 17,000 feet, but not at the expense of waiting over half a day. I called Oppenheimer and General Farrell to get their agreement that 5:30 a.m. would be T equals zero. Hubbard, Bainbridge, Oppenheimer, and Farrell each had veto over the shot. They all agreed. Trinity would fire at 0530 hours, July 16, 1945, just before dawn. Bainbridge had arranged to report each step of the final arming process to S-10000 in case anything went wrong. I drove McKiven to W-900 so that he could throw the timing and sequence switches while I checked off his list. Back at zero, Bainbridge called in the next step and threw the special arming switch, which was not on McKibben's lines. Until this switch was closed, the bomb could not be detonated from S-10000. The final task was to switch on a string of lights on the ground, which were to serve as an aiming point for a B-29 practice bombing run. The Air Force wanted to know what the blast effects would be like on a plane 30,000 feet up and some miles away. After turning on the lights, I returned to my car and drove to S-10000. Kistiakowski, McKibben, and the security guards rode with him. They were the last to leave the site. Behind them, searchlight beams converged on the tower. The arming party arrived at S-10000, the earth-sheltered concrete control bunker, at about 0508. Hubbard gave Bainbridge his signed forecast. "I unlocked the master switches," Bainbridge concludes, and McKibben started the timing sequence at negative 20 minutes, 5:09:45 a.m. Oppenheimer would watch the shot from S-10000, as would Farrell, Donald Hornig, and Samuel Allison. With the beginning of the final countdown, Groves left by jeep for base camp. For protection against common disaster, he wanted to be physically separated from Farrell and Oppenheimer. Busloads of visitors from Los Alamos and beyond had begun arriving at Compania Hill, the viewing site 20 miles northwest of zero at 0200. Ernest Lawrence was there, Hans Bethe, Teller, Serber, Enwood McMillan, James Chadwick come to see what his neutron was capable of, and a crowd of other men, including Trinity staff no longer needed down on the plain. With the darkness and the waiting in the chill of the desert, the tension became almost unendurable, one of them remembers. The shortwave radio requisitioned to advise them of the schedule refused to work until after Allison began broadcasting the countdown. Richard Feynman, a future Nobel laureate who had entered physics as an adolescent via radio tinkering, tinkered the radio to life. Men began moving into position. "We were told to lie down on the sand," Teller protests, "turn our faces away from the blast, and bury our heads in our arms." No one complied. "We were determined to look the beast in the eye." The radio went dead again, and they were left to watch for the warning rockets to be fired from S-10000. "I wouldn't turn away, but having made all those calculations, I thought the blast might be rather bigger than expected. So I put on some suntan lotion." Teller passed the lotion around, and the strange prophylaxis disturbed one observer. "It was an eerie sight to see a number of our highest-ranking scientists seriously rubbing sunburn lotion on their faces and hands in the pitch blackness of the night, 20 miles from the expected flash." The countdown continued at S-10000. At 0525, a green, very rocket went up. That signaled a short wail of the siren at base camp. Shallow trenches had been bulldozed below the south rim of the base camp reservoir for protection, and since these men watched 10 miles closer to zero than the crowd on Compania Hill, they planned to use them. Robbie lay down next to Kenneth Greeson, a Cornell physicist, facing south, away from zero. Greeson remembers that he was personally nervous, for my group had prepared and installed the detonators, and if the shot turned out to be a dud, it might possibly be our fault. Groves found refuge between Bush and Conant, thinking only of what I would do if, when the countdown got to zero, nothing happened. Victor Weisskopf remembers that groups of observers had arranged small wooden sticks at a distance of 10 yards from our observation place in order to estimate the size of the explosion. The sticks were posted on the rim of the reservoir. They were arranged so that their height corresponded to 1,000 feet at zero point. Philip Morrison relayed the countdown to the base camp observers by loudspeaker. The 2-minute warning rocket fizzled. A long wail of the base camp siren signaled the time. The 1-minute warning rocket fired at 0529. Morrison also meant to look the beast in the eye and lay down on the slope of the reservoir facing zero. He wore sunglasses and held a stopwatch in one hand and a piece of welder's glass in the other. The welder's glass was stockroom issue, Lincoln supervisibility lens, shade number 10. At S-10,000, someone heard Oppenheimer say, "Lord, these affairs are hard on the heart." McKibben had been marking off the minutes and Allison broadcasting them. At 45 seconds, McKibben turned on a more precise automatic timer. "The control post was rather crowded," Kistiakowsky notes, "and having now nothing to do, I left as soon as the automatic timer was thrown in and went to stand on the earth mound covering the concrete dugout. My own guess was that the yield would be about 1 kT, that is 1,000 tons, 1 kiloton, and so 5 miles seemed very safe." Teller prepared himself further at Compania Hill. "I put on a pair of dark glasses. I pulled on a pair of heavy gloves. With both hands, I pressed the welder's glass to my face, making sure no stray light could penetrate around it. I then looked straight at the aiming point." Donald Hornig at S-10,000 monitored a switch that could cut the connection between his X-unit in the tower and the bomb, the last point of interruption, if anything went wrong. At 30 seconds before T equals zero, 4 red lights flashed on the console in front of him, and a voltmeter needle flipped from left to right under its round glass cover to register the full charging of the X-unit. Farrell noticed that Dr. Oppenheimer, on whom had rested a very heavy burden, grew tenser as the last seconds ticked off. He scarcely breathed. He held onto a post to steady himself. For the last few seconds, he stared directly ahead. At 10 seconds, a gong sounded in the control bunker. The men lying in their shallow trenches at base camp might have been laid out for death. Conant told Groves he never imagined seconds could be so long. Morrison studied his stopwatch. "I watched the second hand until T equals -5 seconds, he wrote the day of the shot, "when I lowered my head onto the sandbank in such a way that a slight rise in the ground completely shielded me from zero. I placed the welding glass over the right lens of my sunglasses, the left lens of which was covered by an opaque cardboard shield. I counted seconds, and at zero, began to raise my head just over the protecting rise." Ernest Lawrence at Compania Hill had planned to watch the shot through the windshield of a car, allowing the glass to filter out damaging ultraviolet, but at the last minute decided to get out. "Evidence, indeed, I was excited." Robert Serber, his bottles of whiskey to succor him, stared 20 miles toward distant zero with unprotected eyes. The last decisive inaction was Hornig's. Now the sequence of events was all controlled by the automatic timer, except that I had the knife switch, which could stop the test at any moment up until the actual firing. I don't think I've ever been keyed up as I was during those final seconds. I kept telling myself, "The least flicker of that needle, and you have to act." It kept on coming down to zero. I kept saying, "Your reaction time is about 0.5 seconds, and you can't relax for even a fraction of a second." My eyes were glued on the dial, and my hand was on the switch. I could hear the timer counting. 3, 2, 1. The needle fell to zero. Time? 0529:45. The firing circuit closed. The X unit discharged. The detonators at 32 detonation points simultaneously fired. They ignited the outer lens shells of Composition B. The detonation waves separately bulged, encountered inclusions of Baritol, slowed, curved, turned inside out, merged to a common inward-driving sphere. The spherical detonation wave crossed into the second shell of solid fast composition B and accelerated, hit the wall of dense uranium tamper, and became a shockwave and squeezed, liquefying, moving through, hit the nickel plating of the plutonium core and squeezed, the small sphere shrinking, collapsing into itself, becoming an eyeball, the shockwave reaching the tiny initiator at the center and swirling through its designed irregularities to mix its beryllium and polonium. Polonium alphas kicking neutrons free from scant atoms of beryllium. 1, 2, 7, 9, hardly more neutrons drilling into the surrounding plutonium to start the chain reaction. Then fission, multiplying its prodigious energy release through 80 generations in millionths of a second, tens of millions of degrees, millions of pounds of pressure. Before the radiation leaked away, conditions within the eyeball briefly resembled the state of the universe moments after its first primordial explosion. Then expansion, radiation leaking away. The radiant energy loosed by the chain reaction is hot enough to take the form of soft X-rays. These leave the physical bomb and its physical casing first, at the speed of light, far in front of any mere explosion. Cool air is opaque to X-rays and absorbs them, heating. The very hot air, Hans Bethe writes, is therefore surrounded by a cooler envelope, and only this envelope, hot enough at that, is visible to observers at a distance. The central sphere of air, heated by the X-rays it absorbs, re-emits lower energy X-rays, which are absorbed in turn at its boundaries and re-emitted beyond. By this process of downhill leapfrogging, which is known as radiation transport, the hot sphere begins to cool itself. When it has cooled to 500,000 degrees in about 1/10,000th of a second, a shock wave forms that moves out faster than radiation transport can keep up. The shock therefore separates from the very hot, nearly isothermal, that is, uniformly heated, sphere at the center, Bethe explains. Simple hydrodynamics describes the shock front, like a wave in water, like a sonic boom in air. It moves on, leaving behind the isothermal sphere confined within its shell of opacity, isolated from the outside world, growing only slowly by radiation transport in this millisecond scale of events. What the world sees is the shock front, and it cools into visibility, the first flash, milliseconds long, of a nuclear weapon's double flash of light. The flash is too closely spaced to distinguish with the eye. Further cooling renders the front transparent. The world, if it still has eyes to see, looks through the shockwave into the hotter interior of the fireball. And because higher temperatures are now revealed, Bethe continues, the total radiation increases toward a second maximum. The second, longer flash. The isothermal sphere at the center of the expanding fireball continues opaque and invisible, but it also continues to give up its energy to the air beyond its boundaries by radiation transport. That is, as the shockwave cools, the air behind it heats. A cooling wave moves in reverse of the shockwave, eating into the isothermal sphere. Instead of one simple thing, the fireball is thus several things at once, an isothermal sphere invisible to the world, a cooling wave moving inward toward that sphere, eating away its radiation, a shock front propagating into undisturbed air, air that has not yet heard the news. Between each of these parts lay further intervening regions of buffering air. Eventually, the cooling wave eats the isothermal sphere completely away, and the entire fireball becomes transparent to its own radiation. Now it cools more slowly. Below about 9,000 degrees Fahrenheit, it can cool no more. Then, concludes Bethe, any further cooling can only be achieved by the rise of the fireball due to its buoyancy, and the turbulent mixing associated with this rise. This is a slow process, taking tens of seconds. The high-speed cameras at W10000 recorded the later stages of the fireball's development, Bainbridge reports, tracking its huge swelling from the eyeball it had been. The expansion of the ball of fire before striking the ground was almost symmetric. Except for the extra brightness and retardation of a part of the sphere near the bottom, a number of blisters and several spikes that shot radially ahead of the ball below the equator. Contact with the ground was made at 0.65 milliseconds, that is thousandths of a second. Thereafter, the ball became rapidly smoother. Shortly after the spike struck the ground, about 2 ms, there appeared on the ground ahead of the shockwave a wide skirt of lumpy matter. At about 32 ms, when the fireball had expanded to 945 feet in diameter, there appeared immediately behind the shockwave a dark front of absorbing matter, which traveled slowly out until it became invisible at 0.85 s, the expanding front about 2,500 feet across. The shockwave itself became invisible earlier, at about 0.1 s. The ball of fire grew even more slowly to a diameter of about 2,000 feet until the dust cloud growing out of the skirt almost enveloped it. The top of the ball started to rise again at 2 s. At 3.5 s, a minimum horizontal diameter, or neck, appeared one-third of the way up the skirt, and the portion of the skirt above the neck formed a vortex ring. The neck narrowed, and the ring and fast-growing pile of matter above it rose as a new cloud of smoke, carrying a convection stem of dust behind it. The stem appeared twisted, like a left-handed screw. But men saw what theoretical physics cannot notice, and what cameras cannot record, saw pity and terror. Robbie, at base camp, felt menaced. We were lying there, very tense, in the early dawn, and there were just a few streaks of gold in the east. You could see your neighbor very dimly. Those 10 seconds were the longest 10 seconds that I ever experienced. Suddenly, there was an enormous flash of light, the brightest light I have ever seen, or that I think anyone has ever seen. It blasted. Pounced, it bored its way right through you. It was a vision which was seen with more than the eye. It was seen to last forever. You would wish it would stop. Altogether, it lasted about 2 seconds. Finally, it was over, diminishing, and we looked toward the place where the bomb had been. There was an enormous ball of fire which grew and grew. And it rolled as it grew. It went up into the air in yellow flashes and into scarlet and green. It looked menacing. It seemed to come toward one. A new thing had just been born. A new control. A new understanding of man, which man had acquired over nature. To Teller, at Campania Hill, the burst was like opening the heavy curtains of a darkened room to a flood of sunlight. Had astronomers been watching, they could have seen it reflected from the moon, literal moonshine. Joseph McKiven made a comparison at S-10000. We had a lot of floodlights on for taking movies of the control panel. When the bomb went off, the lights were drowned out by the big light coming in through the open door in the back. It caught Ernest Lawrence at Campania Hill in the act of stepping from his car. Just as I put my foot on the ground, I was enveloped with a warm, brilliant, yellow-white light. From darkness to brilliant sunshine in an instant, and as I remember, I momentarily was stunned by the surprise. To Hans Bethe at Campania Hill, it looked like a giant magnesium flare which kept on for what seemed like a whole minute. It was actually 1 or 2 seconds. Serber at Campania Hill risked blindness, but glimpsed an earlier stage of the fireball. At the instant of the explosion, I was looking directly at it, with no eye protection of any kind. I saw first a yellow glow, which grew almost instantly to an overwhelming white flash, so intense that I was completely blinded. By 20 or 30 seconds after the explosion, I was regaining normal vision. The grandeur and magnitude of the phenomenon were completely breathtaking. Segre, at base camp, imagined apocalypse. The most striking impression was that of an overwhelmingly bright light. I was flabbergasted by the new spectacle. We saw the whole sky flash with unbelievable brightness in spite of the very dark glasses we wore. I believe that for a moment I thought the explosion might set fire to the atmosphere and thus finish the Earth, even though I knew that this was not possible. Not light, but heat disturbed Morrison at base camp. From 10 miles away, we saw the unbelievably brilliant flash. That was not the most impressive thing. We knew it was going to be blinding. We wore welder's glasses. The thing that got me was not the flash, but the blinding heat of a bright day on your face in the cold desert morning. It was like opening a hot oven with the sun coming out like a sunrise. It unfolded in silence, a ballistics expert watching from Campania Hill realized with awe. The flash of light was so bright at first as to seem to have no definite shape, but after perhaps half a second, it looked bright yellow and hemispherical with the flat side down, like a half-risen sun, but about twice as large. Almost immediately, a turgid rising of this luminous mass began, great swirls of flame seeming to ascend within a rather rectangular outline which expanded rapidly in height. Suddenly, out of the center of it, there seemed to rise a narrower column to a considerably greater height. Then, as a climax, which was exceedingly impressive in spite of the fact that the blinding brightness had subsided, the top of the slender column seemed to mushroom out into a thick parasol of a rather bright but spectral blue. All this seemed very fast, and was followed by a feeling of letdown that it was all over so soon. Then came the awe-inspiring realization that it was 20 miles away, that what had flared up and died so brilliantly and quickly was really a couple of miles high. The feeling of the remoteness of this thing, which had seemed so near, was emphasized by the long silence while we watched the gray smoke grow into a taller and taller twisting column. A silence broken after a minute or so that seemed much longer by a quite impressive bang, about like the crack of a 5-inch anti-aircraft gun at 100 yards. Most experiences in life can be comprehended by prior experiences, Norris Bradbury comments. But the atom bomb did not fit into any preconceptions possessed by anybody. As the fireball rose into the air, Joseph W. Kennedy reports, the overcast of stratocumulus clouds directly overhead became pink on the underside and well illuminated, as at a sunrise. Weisskopf noticed that the path of the shockwave through the clouds was plainly visible as an expanding circle all over the sky where it was covered by clouds. When the red glow faded out, writes Edwin McMillan, a most remarkable effect made its appearance. The whole surface of the ball was covered with a purple luminescence, like that produced by the electrical excitation of the air, and caused undoubtedly by the radioactivity of the material in the ball. Fermi had prepared an order of magnitude experiment to determine roughly the bomb's yield. At about 40 seconds after the explosion, the air blast reached me. I tried to estimate its strength by dropping from about 6 feet small pieces of paper before, during, and after the passage of the blast wave. Since, at the time, there was no wind, I could observe very distinctly and actually measure the displacement of the pieces of paper that were in the process of falling while the blast was passing. The shift was about 2.5 meters, which, at the time, I estimated to correspond to the blast that would be produced by 10,000 tons of TNT. From the distance of the source and from the displacement of the air due to the shock wave, Segre explains, he could calculate the energy of the explosion. This Fermi had done in advance, having prepared himself a table of numbers, so that he could tell immediately the energy liberated from this crude but simple measurement. He was so profoundly and totally absorbed in his bits of paper, adds Laura Fermi, that he was not aware of the tremendous noise. Frank Oppenheimer found his brother watching beside him outside the control bunker at S-10,000. And so there was this sense of this ominous cloud hanging over us. It was so brilliant purple, with all the radioactive glowing, and it just seemed to hang there forever. Of course it didn't. It must have been just a very short time until it went up. It was very terrifying. And the thunder from the blast, it bounced on the rocks, and then it went, I don't know where else it bounced, but it never seemed to stop. Not like an ordinary echo with thunder. It just kept echoing back and forth in that Jornada del Muerto. It was a very scary time when it went off. And I wish I would remember what my brother said, but I can't. But I think we just said it worked. I think that's what we said, both of us. It worked. Trinity director Bainbridge appropriately pronounced its benediction. No one who saw it could forget it. A foul and awesome display. At base camp, Groves personally thought of Blondin crossing Niagara Falls on his tightrope. Only to me, the tightrope had lasted for almost 3 years, and of my repeated, confident-appearing assurances that such a thing was possible and that we would do it. Sitting up in their trenches before the blast wave arrived, he and Conant and Bush ceremoniously shook hands. The blast had knocked Kistiakowski down at S-10,000. He scrambled up to watch the fireball rise and darken and mushroom purple auras, then moved to claim his bet. I slapped Oppenheimer on the back and said, Oppie, you owe me $10. The distracted Los Alamos director searched his wallet. It's empty, he told Kistiakowski. You'll have to wait. Bainbridge went around congratulating the S-10,000 leaders on the success of the implosion method. I finished by saying to Robert, Now we are all sons of bitches. He told my younger daughter later that it was the best thing anyone said after the test. Our first feeling was one of elation, Weisskopf remembers. Then we realized we were tired, and then we were worried, Robbie elaborates. Naturally, we were very jubilant over the outcome of the experiment. While this tremendous ball of flame was there before us, and we watched it, and it rolled along, it became in time diffused with the clouds. Then it was washed out with the wind. We turned to one another and offered congratulations for the first few minutes. Then there was a chill, which was not the morning cold. It was a chill that came to one when one thought, as, for instance, when I thought, of my wooden house in Cambridge and my laboratory in New York, and of the millions of people living around there, and this power of nature, which we had first understood it to be, well, there it was. Oppenheimer looked again into the Gita for a model sufficiently scaled. We waited until the blast had passed, walked out of the shelter, and then it was extremely solemn. We knew the world would not be the same. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty, and to impress him, he takes on his multi-armed form and says, Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that, one way or another. Other models also came to mind, Oppenheimer told an audience shortly after the war. When it went off in the New Mexico dawn, that first atomic bomb, we thought of Alfred Nobel and his hope, his vain hope, that dynamite would put an end to wars. We thought of the legend of Prometheus, of that deep sense of guilt in man's new powers that reflects his recognition of evil and his long knowledge of it. We knew that it was a new world, but even more, we knew that novelty itself was a very old thing in human life, that all our ways are rooted in it. The successful director of the Los Alamos Bomb Laboratory left with Ferrell in a Jeep. Robbie watched him arrive at base camp and saw a change. He was in the forward bunker. When he came back, there he was, you know, with his hat. You've seen pictures of Robert's hat, and he came to where we were in the headquarters, so to speak, and his walk was like high noon. I think it's the best I could describe it. This kind of strut. He'd done it.
When Ferrell came up to me, Groves continues the story, his first words were, "The war is over." My reply was, "Yes," after we dropped two bombs on Japan. I congratulated Oppenheimer quietly with, "I am proud of you," and he replied with a simple thank you. The theoretical physicist, who was also a poet, who found physics, as Bethe says, the best way to do philosophy, had staked his claim on history. It was a larger claim, but more ambivalent than any Nobel Prize. The horses in the MP stable still whinnied in fright. The paddles of the dusty air motor windmill at base camp still spun away the energy of the blast. The frogs had ceased to make love in the puddles. Robbie broke out a bottle of whiskey and passed it around. Everyone took a swig. Oppenheimer went to work with Groves on a report for Stimson at Potsdam. "My faith in the human mind has been somewhat restored," Hubbard overheard him say. He estimated the blast at 21,000 tons, 21 kilotons. Fermi knew from his paper experiment that it was at least 10 kilotons. Robbie had wagered 18. Later that morning, Fermi and Herbert Anderson would don white surgical scrub suits and board the two lead-lined tanks to drive near zero. Fermi's tank broke down after only a mile of approach, and he had to walk back. Anderson clanked on. Through the periscope, the young physicist studied the crater the bomb had made. The tower, the $20,000 winch, the shack, the wooden platform, the 100 feet of steel girders, was gone, vaporized down to the stubby, twisted wreckage of its footings. What had been asphalt paving was now fused sand, green and translucent as jade. The cup strung to Anderson's rocket scooped up debris. His later radiochemical measurements confirmed 18.6 KT. That was nearly four times what Los Alamos had expected. Robbie won the pot. Fermi experienced a delayed reaction, he told his wife. For the first time in his life, on coming back from Trinity, he had felt it was not safe for him to drive. It had seemed to him as if the car were jumping from curve to curve, skipping the straight stretches in between. He had asked a friend to drive, despite his strong aversion to being driven. Stanislaw Ulam, who chose not to attend the shot, watched the buses returning. You could tell at once they had had a strange experience. You could see it on their faces. I saw that something very grave and strong had happened to their whole outlook on the future. A bomb exploded in a desert damages not much besides sand and cactus and the purity of the air. Stafford Warren, the physician responsible for radiological safety at Trinity, had to search to discover more lethal effects. Partially eviscerated dead wild jackrabbits were found more than 800 yards from zero, presumably killed by the blast. A farmhouse 3 miles away had doors torn loose and suffered other extensive damage. The light intensity was sufficient at 9 miles to have caused temporary blindness, and this would be longer lasting at shorter distances. The light, together with the heat and ultraviolet radiation, would probably cause severe damage to the unprotected eye at 5 to 6 miles. Damage sufficient to put personnel out of action several days, if not permanently. The boxes of Excelsior Frank Oppenheimer had set out, and the pine boards, also recorded the coming of the light. They were charred beyond 1,000 yards, slightly scorched up to 2,000 yards. At 1,520 yards, 9/10 of a mile, exposed surfaces had heated almost instantly to 750 degrees Fahrenheit. William Penny, the British physicist who had studied blast effects for the Target Committee, held a seminar at Los Alamos 5 days after Trinity. He applied his calculations, Philip Morrison remembers. He predicted that this weapon would reduce a city of 300,000 or 400,000 people to nothing but a sink for disaster relief, bandages, and hospitals. He made it absolutely clear in numbers. It was reality. Around the time of the Trinity shot, in the pre-dawn dark at Hunter's Point in San Francisco Bay, a floodlit crane had loaded onto the dock of the Indianapolis the 15-foot crate that carried the little boy gun assembly. Two sailors carried aboard the little boy bullet in a lead bucket shouldered between them on a crowbar. They followed the two Los Alamos Army officers to the cabin of the ship's flag lieutenant, who had vacated it for the voyage. Eye bolts had been welded to its deck. The sailors strapped the lead bucket to the eye bolts. One of the officers padlocked it into place. They would take turns guarding it around the clock for the 10-day voyage to Tinian. At 0836 Pacific War Time, 4 hours after the light flung from the Jornada del Muerto blanched the face of the moon, the Indianapolis sailed with its cargo under the Golden Gate and out to sea. 19. Tongues of Fire. At the end of March 1945, as Curtis LeMay's bombers shuttled back and forth burning cities, Colonel Elmer E. Kirkpatrick, a plain-spoken Army engineer, arrived in the Marianas to locate a small corner where he could lodge Paul Tibbetts' 509th Composite Group. Kirkpatrick met with LeMay and then with Pacific Fleet Commander Chester Nimitz on Guam on the day he arrived, March 30th, and found the commanding officers cooperative. LeMay personally flew Kirkpatrick to Tinian on April 3rd. The next day, he reported to Groves he covered most of the island and decided on our sites, and the planning forces went to work on layouts. Though there was no shortage of B-29s, he found that cement and buildings were scarce. Housing and life here is a little rugged for everyone except general officers and the Navy. Tents or open barracks. Kirkpatrick flew back to Guam on April 5th to dig up some materials someplace and to get authority for the work I required. Threaded his way through the Air Force and Navy chains of command with his letters of authority from Washington, and by the end of the day had sent a telex to Saipan directing them to give me enough material to get the essential things done. A Navy construction battalion, the Seabees, would build the buildings and hard stands and dig the pits from which the bombs, too large for ground-level clearance, would be lifted up into the bomb bays of Tibbetts' B-29s. By early June, when Tibbetts arrived to inspect the accommodations and confer with LeMay, Kirkpatrick could report that progress has been very satisfactory, and I have the feeling now that we can't miss. He sat in on an evening meeting between Tibbetts and LeMay and heard evidence that the 20th Air Force commander did not yet appreciate the power of an atomic bomb. LeMay does not favor high-altitude bombing. Work is not as accurate, but more important, visibility at such altitudes is extremely poor, especially during the period June to November. Tibbetts advised him that the weapon would destroy a plane using it at an altitude of less than 25,000 feet. Kirkpatrick demonstrated his progress to Groves with an impressive list: 5 warehouses, an administration building, roads and parking areas, and 9 magazines completed, pits completed except for lifts, hard stands for parking the 509th aircraft completed except for asphalt paving, generator buildings and compressor shed completed, 1 air-conditioned building where the bombs would be assembled to be completed by July 1st, 2 more assembly buildings to be completed by August 1st and August 15th. Of the 509th men, more than 1,100 had already staged out by ship, and more coming in every week. The first of Tibbet's combat crews arrived June 10th, flying themselves to Tinian in advanced, specially modified new B-29s. The early model aircraft delivered to the group the previous autumn had become obsolete. Tibbets explained to readers of the Saturday Evening Post after the war. "Tests showed us that the B-29s we had weren't good enough for atom bombing. They were heavy, older types. Top cylinders were overheating and causing valve failures in the long climb to 30,000 feet at 80% full power. I asked for new, lightweight B-29s and fuel injection systems to replace carburetors." He got those improvements and more. Quick closing pneumatic bomb doors, fuel flow meters, reversible electric propellers. The new aircraft had been modified to accommodate the special bombs they would carry and the added crew. The cylindrical tunnel that connected the pressurized forward and waist sections of the plane had to be partly cut away and reworked so that the larger bomb, Fat Man, would fit in the forward bomb bay. Guide rails were installed to prevent the tail assemblies from hanging up during fallout. An extra table, chair, oxygen outlet, and interphone station for the weaponeers responsible for monitoring a bomb during flight went in forward of the radio operator station in the forward section. "The performance of these special B-29s was exceptional," writes the engineer in charge of their procurement. "They were, without a doubt, the finest B-29s in the theater." By the end of June, 11 of the new bombers shone on their hardstands in the Pacific sun. To men used to the blizzards and dust of Wendover, Utah, the 509th's historian claims Tinian looked like the Garden of Paradise. The surrounding blue ocean and the palm groves may have occasioned that vision. Philip Morrison, who came out after Trinity to help assemble Fat Man, saw more reverberantly what the island had become, as he told a committee of U.S. senators later in 1945. "Tinian is a miracle. Here, 6,000 miles from San Francisco, the United States Armed Forces have built the largest airport in the world. A great coral ridge was half-leveled to fill a rough plain, and to build 6 runways, each an excellent 10-lane highway, each almost 2 miles long. Beside these runways stood in long rows the great silvery airplanes. They were there not by the dozen, but by the hundred. From the air, this island, smaller than Manhattan, looked like a giant aircraft carrier, its deck loaded with bombers. And all these gigantic preparations had a grand and terrible outcome. At the sunset someday, the field would be loud with the roar of motors. Down the great runways would roll the huge planes, seeming to move slowly because of their size, but far outspeeding the occasional racing jeep. One after another, each runway would launch its planes. Once every 15 seconds, another B-29 would become airborne. For an hour and a half, this would continue with precision and order. The sun would go below the sea, and the last planes could still be seen in the distance, with running lights still on. Often, a plane would fail to make the takeoff and go skimming horribly into the sea or into the beach to burn like a huge torch. We came often to sit on top of the coral ridge and watch the combat strike of the 313th Wing in real awe. Most of the planes would return the next morning, standing in a long single line, like beads on a chain, from just overhead to the horizon. You could see 10 or 12 planes at a time, spaced a couple of miles apart. As fast as the near plane would land, another would appear on the edge of the sky. There were always the same number of planes in sight. The empty field would fill up, and in an hour or two, all the planes would have landed. A resemblance in shape between Tinian and Manhattan had inspired the Seabees to name the island's roads for New York City streets. The 509th happened to be lodged immediately west of North Field at 125th Street and 8th Avenue, near Riverside Drive in Manhattan, the environs of Columbia University, where Enrico Fermi and Leo Szilard had identified secondary neutrons from fission. The wheel had come full circle. The first half of July, Norman Ramsey writes, of the 509th activity, was occupied with establishing and installing all of the technical facilities needed for assembly and test work at Tinian. In the meantime, the group's flight crews practiced navigating to Iwo Jima and back, and bombing with standard general-purpose bombs, and then with Pumpkins, such bypassed islands still nominally in Japanese hands, as Rota and Truk. Harry Truman and Jimmy Burns left suburban Potsdam in an open car to tour ravaged Berlin at about the same time on July 16, 1945, that Groves and Oppenheimer at Trinity were preparing their first report of the tower shot's success. The Potsdam conference, appropriately coded terminal, was supposed to have begun that afternoon, but Joseph Stalin was late arriving by armored train from Moscow. He apparently suffered a mild heart attack the previous day. The Berlin tour gave Truman an opportunity to view at close hand the damage Allied bombing and Red Army shelling had done. Burns was officially Secretary of State now, invested in a sweltering ceremony in the White House Rose Garden on July 3rd, attended by a crowd of his former House, Senate, and Supreme Court colleagues. After Burns swore the oath of office, Truman had kidded him, "Jimmy, kiss the Bible." Burns complied, then gave as good as he got, passed the Bible to the president, and bade him kiss it as well. Truman did so, understanding the byplay between the former vice president and the man who had missed his turn. The crowd laughed. 4 days later, the two leaders boarded the cruiser Augusta for the Atlantic crossing to Antwerp, and now they rode side by side into Berlin, conquerors in snap-brim hats and natty worsteds. Though he had arrived before them in Potsdam, Henry Stimson did not accompany the president and his favorite advisor on their tour. The Secretary of War had consulted with Truman the day before Burns' swearing-in, proposing to give the Japanese a warning of what is to come and definite opportunity to capitulate. And as he was leaving, had asked the president plaintively if he had not invited his Secretary of War to attend the forthcoming conference out of solicitude for his health. That was it, Truman had said quickly, and Stimson had replied that he could manage the trip and would like to go, that Truman ought to have advice from the top civilians in our department. The next day, the day of Burns's investiture, Truman accorded the elderly statesman permission. But Stimson had traveled separately on the military transport Brazil via Marseille, was lodged separately in Potsdam from the president and his secretary of state, and would not be included in their daily private discussions. One of Stimson's aides felt that Secretary Burns was a little resentful of Mr. Stimson's presence there. The Secretary of the Navy wasn't there, so why should Mr. Stimson be there? Burns, in his 1947 account of his career, speaking frankly, narrates an entire chapter about Potsdam without once mentioning Stimson's name, relegating his rival to a brief separate discussion of the decision to use the atomic bomb on Japan and awarding him there the dubious honor of having chosen the targets. In fact, Stimson at Potsdam would be reduced to serving Truman and Burns as not much more than a messenger boy, but the messages he brought were fateful. "We reviewed the 2nd Armored Division," Truman reports his Berlin tour in his impromptu diary. "General J.H. Collier, who seemed to know his stuff, put us in a reconnaissance car built with side seats and no top, just like a hoodlum wagon minus the top, or a fire truck with seats and no hose. And we drove slowly down a mile and a half of good soldiers and some millions of dollars worth of equipment, which had amply paid its way."